Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Playhouse Liverpool. Please welcome a man who's looking out for university lecturers. Is Richard Herring. Oh, man alive. How lovely to be here. Hello, Liverpool. Fantastic. How lovely to see you. Welcome to Richard Herring's Liverpool Sunny Torture podcast. It's never been this hot in Liverpool before. And we may have some deaths in the audience. It's been a beautiful day. But I was bumming one of the Liverbirds today. Not Neris Hughes, one of the actual... I'd scaled the Liver building, got up there. You got it, it's one of the traditions, isn't it, when you come to Liverpool. The female one, doesn't make a difference, the cloaca's the same in both. Right in the cloaca. While it was doing it, it called it Rahalastapas. I don't know if that's... That's going to catch on. Like I say, the university lecture thing, if you're unaware, it was 16 years ago, I think. I did a show here, and afterwards I had a middle-class fight with a university lecturer on the streets of Liverpool, and oh, my T-shirt was ripped off. It was terror, got kicked in the ball, you know, and actually, if that guy's around, that might be one of the reasons... That ball took a bit of damage. I was in Barbados and I got knocked over in the sea and it expanded up three or four times the size. And then it got kicked in the balls by a university lecturer in Liverpool and then now it's gone. It's gone. Anyway, never mind. I've been looking up facts about Liverpool to find out what... I thought I knew most things about Liverpool. I did not know that King John designed Liverpool. That was a surprise to me. It's such a individual city and such a sort of anti-English city to think of the worst king in England put it together. This is just an interesting fact. There was seven streets in Liverpool to begin with in an H shape. I don't know why I didn't make it in a J shape. That's what I'd have done if I'd been King John. And the High Street used to be called Juggler Street. And I don't know why have they changed that. Juggler Street. I'm just annoyed. He created the port in order to launch attacks on Ireland. Without having to pay the people of Chester port duties. That's the reason he did it.
But look, the island, or the Irish have had the last laugh, haven't they? Because they now own Liverpool. So it's fine. So bad luck, King John. It didn't work out. There'll be more Liverpool facts coming up. I was going to do this one and I decided it was too offensive. So I'll do it and then we'll cut it. I thought it was too offensive to the people of Liverpool. It isn't really. It's just, it's not that good. Albert Dock is home to one of Liverpool's greatest shames. The floating map of the UK that weather-obsessed nonce Fred Talbot used to leap around on. I think they should have imprisoned him on that, shouldn't they? They should have, like, he's out now. He's out now. I looked it up. Good, we'll leave him. I will mention this now, but I'll mention it again in next week's show, if you can come back for next week's show. I'll be in the Circle Bar after the show, I'm very happy. There's some programs that you can pick up for free and make a donation to Scope. I'm very happy to sign that, do selfies. I will be selling some stuff. I'll mention what that is next week. But let's crack on, because we've got an amazing guest who's already been telling me stories backstage, so I know we're going to get some terrific stuff. He's probably best known, the reason we're here, he's the producer of Shankly Nature's Fire. That's what he's best known for. Will you please welcome the amazing Peter Hooton, ladies and gentlemen? Peter Hooton from Shankly's Nature's Fire. Thank you. Come in. Cheers.
What a fantastic introduction.
That's who you are. Football's a big part of your life. I said to you backstage, I mean, you're at football, you're in a band. Yeah, you hate the sun, you hate the Tories. You're basically Liverpool in human form.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's very difficult, isn't it? Liverpool is, you think it is an anti-establishment city, but yeah. Liverpool's history was based upon sectarianism, and it was a Tory city until the 1960s, basically. A Tory council until the 1960s.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So there's a bit of a mythology about Liverpool being this ultra-left place, because throughout the decades, it's only in recent decades, really, since the 1980s, that Liverpool has been regarded as that, you know?
Yeah, but there's nowhere else in England, I think, that would react to events. I'm not going to go Boris Johnson on you. I'm saying this in a positive way, the fact that you've kept the sun out of the city for 30 years, no other city would do.
Yeah. No. Yeah, and I think that's down to solidarity.
Yeah.
I think it is, and it's been taken off most of the shelves, so you can't even see it, you know. And if someone spots it somewhere, you know, there's a big campaign to go to that shop and pick it.
Right.
You know. So, but. Yeah, that it's a symbolic boycott now. Of course it is, because most of the people have moved on, haven't they? But realistically, Murdoch still owns the papers, doesn't he? So it's,
yeah.
Even though it's... it's one of the best boycotts, I think, since the boycott of South Africa.
Yeah,
you know, it's undoubtedly.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think anywhere else in the UK. I was in Birmingham last night, and they've taken a leaf out of your book and become bankrupt. But... There's sort of the feelings of something great, you know, because that's a place where a lot of cultures are side by side, and it's working out pretty well now. Again, they're not in the
past. Well, I mean, since the capital of culture, you just got to walk around today.
Yeah.
It's, you know, tourism is absolutely booming. You know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
The number of figures, you know, I think there's 107 cruise ships coming to the city this year.
Right.
You know, people are pouring in for everything, not just for the Beatles and music, but for football as well, you know?
Yeah.
And even though I'm a Liverpoolian, you know, I look at the Everton stadium on the waterfront, you know, and I get pretty jealous looking at that. Even though we've got a magnificent stadium, but on the waterfront, it's going to be iconic, isn't it?
You know? Yeah, no, for sure. So, you know, I didn't know this about you, but you started out writing this this football music fanzine called The End. That was sort of one of the first things you did before the farm, right?
Yeah. It wasn't a football fanzine,
no.
Really. We mentioned football, but it started off as a music magazine.
Right.
And one of the lads who did it, called Phil Jones, did a mod fanzine when he was 17. And I was a youth worker in his area, and I thought, this lad must be a genius, you know. I'll get people writing. And the idea was to get the working class writing, you know. Like, they had a Scotland Road Writers' Workshop, and I thought it would be great to do that. And that's how the End started, really. So even though people regarded it as a funny magazine, there wasn't one single joke in it.
Right.
Ever. It was just all observational humour about people, our mates that we knew, or people we'd observed and that, you know. And it went down a storm, and, yeah. You know, it's a legendary magazine, but we never had a business plan, or we never, you know, we used to collect the money in bags and then go on the ale in town, and that was it. And that's where all the ideas came from, was from the pub. They were the best ideas, you know, we'd jot them down on beer mats and go, oh, that'd be funny, yeah.
I mean, but that's incredible, isn't it? That's an incredible thing, you know, that even if it is just to get to have beer for yourselves, to use your creativity and to channel that into something. And again, it's this underground sort of unofficial thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was an underground magazine, no doubt about it. But lots of people from around the country used to write in for it, you know. And I think they were, you know, if we had this thing called the ins and outs column, and that was a piss take on the face, basically, what was going to be fashionable and what wasn't fashionable. And the ins and outs column became a phenomenon itself, you know. Yeah. But we started to get, like, poems and letters, mainly from Her Majesty's prisons. And it was, we had that, you know, we'd read Jimmy Boyle's books, and we could see that art could, you know, emancipate people, you know. And so we were getting, saying, don't mention my name, but I've got this poem, and don't mention my name. So we got all these letters in from all these penal establishments, and people wanted to write, and we thought, isn't this great?
Yeah.
Getting people's work onto paper. Now every cunt's doing it on Facebook, aren't they? And it's absolutely shite, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the problem with the internet is everyone's everywhere, so you can't, you know, if you can get it all in one little place and then hand it out to people, then, you know, you could curate it a little bit, I guess. But before that, you know, I was listening to an interview where you were talking, you almost... we're going to become a priest.
A priest, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was a bit of a different lifestyle.
When I was a kid, my mum said I used to sing Little Donkey at the back of the church, and the priest didn't like it, and saying, you better tell your priest to shut up. That's not the first person who's told me to shut up. But anyway, I used to give out communion, I get dressed as a priest and all that, and my mum's side of the family from a place in town called the Friary. It was a very religious, place, you know, but it was right on the edge of the Orange Lodge area, which is Netherfield Road, where my dad was from. And my dad, to marry my mum, had to go through a 2-year course of induction. And the last 6 months was the intense induction, where he had to go to the presbytery, he said, for 1 hour twice a week to learn the catechism, to learn what the rules of the Catholic Church, just to make sure. And he used to question it all the time. Why is the Mass in Latin? No one understands it. And I actually said to my gran once, when she objected to turning to English, I said, Gran, I didn't know you could speak Latin. She said, I can't. It just sounds better. So my dad, you know, was induced into the Catholic Church, but my gran thought he was a communist because he kept on questioning, you know, you shouldn't eat meat on a Friday, you know, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. And he questioned it all. And they've all been thrown out the window now, you know, those rules.
Well, they don't like you questioning religion because, you know, it does start to fall apart quite quickly under. But they treated you so badly, really. I mean, not as badly as they could have done, the priests. I mean, you got off lightly. they put you off it, basically, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, you see... I mean, when I was growing up, I thought, like, I'd have this religious experience, this emancipation when I made my first Holy Communion, and nothing happened. And I thought, this is weird. I went to my first confession, and you had to do a practice confession. And I had to do it with the nun. She was, like, the stand-in for the priest.
Right.
And I made all these things up. I said, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I have told tales, I've told lies, I've swore at me mum and dad, and I tried to burn the school down. Because they said, make it up.
Yeah.
So I had a fertile imagination. My mum was a dinner lady in the school, and the nun went and told her, I'm worried about your Peter. He said he's going to burn the school down.
And that's against the rules.
That is against the rules. But we also had a priest called Father Meehan. And next to the presbytery, there was a bit of waste ground. And he said to all, we were like 7 and 8. He said, if you dig that up and seed it, you can play football on it next year, because the school didn't have a football pitch.
Right.
So we did it. Next year, knocked around. He said, oh, boys, you can't do it now. No, no. It's like Wembley. That can't be touched now. Went, you bastard. So then we knew, you know, these weren't telling us the truth, you know. Yeah. And then Bill Shankly came along. It was... He became my hero then. He was my messiah, you know.
Yeah.
Because whatever he said, I hung on his every word, you know. And I think if you look at his quotes now, yeah, he could have been a, you know, he could have been a religious leader, could have been a political leader, you know, unbelievable.
But, you know, better than he did what he did. I mean, that's, it's the same with, you know, it's better that you've done what you've done. Imagine wasting your time going into the priesthood when you, with all the, you know, all the happiness you brought with the stuff you've done and all the, all, you know, the joy and everything is, you know, it's an outward thing rather than, like, religion can be a very inward thing, I think, and and music and expressing yourself is.
I'm still scared of the Catholic Church. I've got that Catholic guilt thing.
That's what they work on. I mean, it's, you know, it's great when you're having sex with someone who's a Catholic, because, you know, they're so full of guilt and they throw themselves into it, but then they're sorry about it afterwards. It's the best. It's just the perfect combination. So keep it up, you crazy, perverted vicars and priests, nuns. Keep putting out these emotionally damaged people into the world. So,
don't speak about Jamie Callagher like that. He went to our school.
Well, that's all. That's an interesting bit. With the music, it seems like, I mean, you're into music a little bit, but it seems like it was the Clash that, and Joe Strummer then, that really kind of changed your world in musical terms.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I was into, obviously, I was into Bowie and that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Alex Harvey Band, believe it or not, and a group called Family. I don't remember a group called Family. And then I got a bit, you know, there's a few lads in our school. There was like, there was tribes in our school. There was the Skinheads and the Smoothies and the Trogs. The Trogs were mainly from the middle class areas, you know. And I was in the middle, really, because I like soul music, but I also liked a bit of early Genesis, you know. Right. So we're always looking for the next big thing. You know, someone would come in and say, have you heard this Sun Ra LP? You go, what? That's Sun Ra. And you go, yeah, it's brilliant. So everyone was always looking for the next big thing, but no one's, and I was into Deaf School. I loved Deaf School. And then punk came along and it was just like, you know, that was, you know, it was Saul on the Road to Damascus, that moment, you know. And I saw the Clash many times, you know, but I say never meet your heroes, but I met Joe Strummer and Mick Jones and that in Paris. I went to Paris with Liverpool in 81 and we spent a week wasting on the ale, basically wasting our time. We didn't go to the Palace of Versailles, didn't go to it, the Louvre, didn't look for this mythical Adidas centre, which didn't exist. So then I went back in the September because I wanted to go to Versailles, I wanted to go to all these tourist places. And just so happened, the Clash, Pete Wiley, the Beat and the Clash were on for 7 nights in a place called the Mogador Theatre. And I thought, oh, I'll have to go down and see if I can get in the sound check. So I walked in and someone said, are you with Pete Wiley? I didn't know Pete Wiley. I said, I might be, you know. Like, and anyway, the tour manager come out. He said, what do you want, lad? I said, he said, where are you from? I said, I'm from Liverpool. And he said, so am I. I'm the tour manager. Who do you support? Liverpool. How many tickets do you want? So I went for 7 nights.
Wow.
And every, I wasn't just in the audience, I was backstage.
Right.
So I become, you know, I was eating bits from the rider and drinking from the rider, and I heard the Clash coming up the stairs, so I put the banana away. And as I put it away, I said to Joe Summer, I said, oh, sorry about that, Joe, I was starving. And he went, look, man, we're the Clash, you have what you want. I thought, oh my God, what a hero.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, people like that change your life, and Paul Weller as well.
Yeah.
And after the 7 nights, they went around Paris looking for a nightclub to let them in with like 50 wastrels, you know, me included. And they went to every club and they go, no, the Clash can come in, but get rid of them Paris punks, you know, because they're all. And Joe Strummer said, we're not going in here then. So he waited till somewhere had let him in so we'd all get in.
Right.
What a hero, you know?
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And you. I heard a story about you meeting him a bit down the line, and the Clash. There was a night where you thought you were going to end up, you know, supporting the Clash.
Oh, right, yeah. That was, we were touring in America with Big Old Dynamite.
Yeah.
So we were in a hotel room, and Joe Strummer was deputising for Shane McGowan.
Right.
You know, because Shane McGowan was ill. You know, Shane's still alive, isn't he? No, Joe's been dead for years, you know.
He can't still really. There must be several Shane McGowans in the cupboard somewhere. They just get a new one. Pull it like a rolling piece of hand towel.
Must have been. But anyway, I went to bed early, about 4 in the morning. And then I started getting phone calls. I was answering the phone. I said, hello. He said, it's Joe Sammer. Come to room. Go sit in the room. I said, fuck off. You know, put the phone down. thought it was one of the farm messing around, you know, winding me up. In the end, I think Roy from the group, he answered the phone. He said, no, it's Joe Sammer. I recognise his voice. So we went up to the room and there. And Mick and Joe, and he'd had a fallout, hadn't he? Because Mick had been sacked from his own group, hadn't he, for musical differences or whatever. But by 6 o'clock in the morning, the Clash were reforming and the farm was support in America. You know, and he could have shot me then. You
know. But it didn't happen, unfortunately.
It didn't happen, unfortunately. But I think the last gig they did together before Joe passed away, I think it was a miner's. A fireman's benefit.
Right.
And they got up on stage together, you know, a week before he passed away, I think,
That's great. Yeah, it's amazing. Shane McGowan, it's everyone. Do you think he's just waiting for everyone he's ever worked with has to die first, and then he's allowed to die?
Is it Shane McGowan?
It could be. It's incredible. I didn't know much about the genesis of the farm. Before I sort of started looking into you for this, and it's a really impressive and story, isn't it? Because you're working class lads, and you're working independently, and you sort of managed over the. I mean, it took a little while, but you managed to sort of conquer the whole system.
6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And usually, it's 18 months, and the group are like gone then, aren't they? A&R people. But yeah, we were always on the verge of doing something. Suggs helped us out in 84. 87, Paul Heaton started helping us out. Brian Travis, God rest his soul, from UB40, he tried to get us a record deal. And in the end, we thought, no one's going to sign us, because all the record companies and all the publishing companies were saying, you've got no image. You know, you've got cagoules and tweed jackets and cord jackets. And this was before Oasis, of course, you know. And so you got no image. You've got to be like Kajagoogoo or Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And, and we go, well, this is the way we are. And this is the way we are. We're not changing.
So I'd love to see you with Kajagoogoo hair, though. Nick Begg's hair.
Well, we did. I wish you'd done it. We did a cover once for Ruby Tracks for the NME. And I did have a Phil Oakey wig on. And that's impressive, one of those big... But it was... So in the end, we thought we'd do it ourselves, you know. And it was really our manager, Kevin Sampson, who's an author now, and he just did Anne, the documentary on Anne Williams, the drama documentary, and also In Search of Ralph Moat, is it? You know, he wrote that as well. So he's an author, Kevin, and he was a genius. He was our Malcolm McLaren, really, and he set everything up, really. So he got in touch with Suggs in London again, said, would you produce us? Got in touch with Terry Farley, got in touch with Pluggers, and we didn't have a clue, really, you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
But Kevin was saying, do this, do that. As soon as we had success, of course, all the group started having opinions. We want to do this, we want to do... And we're in the middle of America, and we're in New York, and the Dakota Buildings down the road where Lennon lived, you know. And everyone go, wait until Kevin Sampson comes tomorrow. We're going to have, you know, we haven't had this, we haven't had that. So we're in America touring. Anyway, Kevin turned up pissed and with Suggs and my mate Mick Potter. And the emergency meeting was abandoned.
Right. But it's amazing. I didn't, when I've had Suggs on the podcast, and he didn't talk about you at all.
The bastard.
I think they recognised something in both of you. I mean, both of you were a group of lads and who didn't fit into a lot of those other bands that were going on at that time.
You know, our videos ideas came from the likes of Madness, because we had characters in them. They always had characters, they always getting dressed up, weren't they? But, you know, we had Frankie Howard in one of ours.
Right,
we had George Best. We spent a week with George Best in London, and it was one of the greatest weeks we've ever had. And it wasn't when he was on the shorts. He said, you won't like me on the shorts, lads. It was when he was on the bottles of lager and that, and we had a great time.
Right.
And but, you know, we did runners from his club. We went to this club, and he got a plate of chips and it was like something like 50 quid. And he said, anyone got any credit cards? No one had credit card. And George said, okay, let's run. So we did a runner with George Best.
Because no one's going to remember who, no one's going to recognise who he was.
Well, they were saying, George, come back. He said, put it on the sleeve.
So it was stepping stone, right? That kind of, it was an unexpected sort of thing that broke you. It's not really a cover, is it? It is a cover.
It went down great in the clubs, around the country. We also had the famous cover, which had a sheep in flares and kickers. And a stuffed sheep, of course. And the actual cover was getting put in clothes shops in London and Manchester and Liverpool as a statement, because the NME at the time was saying that's what the image is of, like, all these groups, these baggy groups and all that. We went, no, we don't dress like that. No one dresses like that. A handful of people, maybe.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a phenomenon, but we didn't release it on 7-inch or cassette or anything like that. You know, it would have all been streaming now, wouldn't it? But, at the time, it was only a 12-inch, so they couldn't keep up with demand. So we had people in London going around with car boots full of records, basically. And we had a midweek of, like, 40 or something. So we thought we were going to get in the top 40, but we never did. It went down, I think, to about mid-50s or something, you know.
Yeah.
But it was the start. Then Kevin said, you're going to Ibiza with Boyzone and Flying. They were all the beautiful people from London who were doing all the stuff in Ibiza.
Right.
We were saying, oh, great. Yeah. How much are we getting? Oh, yeah, you're not getting paid. What do you mean? He said, this is the best publicity you could ever have. Trust me, lads, trust me. So we went. A lot of groups knocked it back.
Yeah.
But we went, and, you know, it was transformational, really, you know.
Yeah. And so you became, you know, the next couple of singles were big, big hits. And the album was the album just had its 30th anniversary quite recently, hasn't it? In the last few years, was, like, very successful.
Yeah.
And so did you go to Sony after that album?
Yeah. I mean, the lads who run the record label, it was one of those situations where, you know, they'd done a fantastic job. It was like an avalanche of, like, success, you know. But when things start going wrong, we're saying, you know, where's the lads from the record company? Oh, they're all in Barbados, you know. They're all in Barbados. And we were trying to promote a single. Yeah. So it was, I think, Kevin's idea, you know, to go to Sony and that, you know. But it was one of those things when we were, like, in America, we'd be playing somewhere like Dallas, you know, and Kevin Sampson would go in the office and they'd say, where are they tonight? And they say, oh, we're in Dallas. And they'd all say, oh, fucking sellouts. You know, that was the attitude, you know. Right. So, you know, it was funny, but, you know, I mean, Jamie Reed, you know, just passed away, Sex Pistols graphics person. He came into Produce Records and he looked at it and went, fucking hell, this is punk rock. No one knows what they're doing. And I think that was the case, you know, but it was just a tidal wave. You couldn't stop it, really, you know. But as soon as things started to go wrong, we were touring in America maybe too much, you know.
Okay.
We signed to Sire, Seymour Stein in Sire Records in America, you know. And maybe we concentrated on that and forgot about writing songs, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? To have success after all that time, to suddenly have big success after grafting and, you know, and sort of flying off in your own directions and doing things because they're fun.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's a business and suddenly there's a big business behind you and you're being offered, I mean, I'm imagining Sony offered you, like, heaps of money.
Well, one of the things we were told by people who had a bit of knowledge, don't employ your mates. Yeah. And at one stage we had about, you know, 15 people on the payroll, which is roadies and all that type of thing. But, you know, it was a big organisation. We actually had a market share in Music Week,
right.
You know, at one stage, you know, but... You know, like everything. But Alan McGee always says, he won't say it publicly, he always says to us, when he got the creation deal with Sony, it was based on the deal we did with Sony, you know.
Right.
But he'll never say that in public, you know. But he always buys us a pint, and that's for
And Oasis owe you a few pints as well, would you say?
They wouldn't. They'd say no, you know. Yeah. But, you know, you never know. What happened was grunge came along. I always remember we'd sold out concerts for 2 years on the run in England. And our promoter, SJM Promotions, one of the biggest promoters now in Europe, and I said, how's the Newcastle sales going? We're playing there the next day. Oh, it hasn't sold out. It hasn't sold out.
Right.
I said, what's happening? He said, there's this group called Nirvana down playing at the university.
Right.
And we'd heard Smells Like Teen Spirit in America, and we loved the song. We thought it was brilliant, but the music press were quite happy with grunge to come along because they didn't understand the Happy Mondays, the Stone Roses, or the groups like that. They didn't understand it. People were experimenting with music, and I think they were quite happy with white guitar groups to come back, you know.
Yeah, but it's the thing with music, isn't it? You become huge. I mean, sometimes you become huge and stay being huge for your whole career, but not very often. But it's really, they're always looking for the next thing. So
yeah,
and the next
yeah.
thing's going to come along, the next yeah. generation's going to go, I don't want to listen to the music my dad listened to or whatever. So
yeah, but
my big brother.
We had an absolutely brilliant time. So sure. We've got no regrets. I mean, no. We've been all over the world. And we've, Kevin's intention was to get us on Top of the Pops. And when he got us on Top of the Pops, he resigned the next day. So we did have an emergency meeting. He said, fuck off, Kevin. You can't resign now. We're just starting. He went, no, that was it. That was in the blueprints. And he said, I'm going to recommend a few managers. We go, fuck off, And that's what happened with it. So we convinced him to carry on, which reluctantly, because he was a writer, you see.
Yeah.
And he wanted to get back to writing, And he's been very successful at writing and that. But, we had a fantastic time. And we still play festivals
going,
now.
And making new music. The new singles just come out this week that recorded this.
Fear the Love.
Yeah, it's great.
And that was about, that was when all the haters on Facebook after Brexit and all that, I just thought, let's do something positive, Fear the Love, And the story is based upon a DJ called Harvey, who we met in Ibiza. And we met him in the Coup Club. After we played, he come up. He had the miner's helmet on with the light on. And he went, come to the mountain with me. Go, what? Are you Harvey the DJ? Yeah. Come to the mountain. It's like a hippie commune. There's no electricity, no running water. But we've got a generator to run the decks in there. So we thought, seems a bit... But anyway, he convinced us because he was so positive, And we went with the van driver. And the van driver at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he resigned on the spot. He said, I'm going home tomorrow, fucking mad. So we went up to this commune, and it was a hippie commune, because, in Ibiza town, there's lots of hippie, there's the hippie market, isn't there, And it was great, but it was just the fact that Harvey was so positive, and, he was like Jesus, going back to religion.
Great. So, obviously the single's available, the track's available sort of on all the streaming.
Well, we're going to release it on streaming platforms.
Yeah.
We don't know what that means. But,
who knows?
But, allegedly that's what people do, But we're going to try and release. We've got about 7 or 8 tracks. We're going to try and release one every few months. Every few weeks, actually.
Yeah.
Whether we're going to do an album, I don't know, but we haven't gone away.
You haven't gone away. And that, that must be, I mean, I know you have been writing stuff all the time, but it's, it's the idea of, would you have imagined that you would still be in the band sort of 30 years on? And would you imagine you'd still have been writing music?
It was accidental that I got in the band anyway.
Yeah.
Because I was staying in my mate's pub and his brother was rehearsing. And I said, well, who's that? I said, oh, that's our Ollie rehearsing. He's got a band. So I went in to watch them. And I said, where's the singer? He said, oh, we haven't got a singer. I said, well, I was in the school of production of Oliver.
Artful Dodger?
I was second in line to be the lead character. But Lionel Bart's Oliver had blonde hair, didn't he?
He did.
So the lad with blonde hair, and I fucking made up, I never got that. Because all the lines you had to learn for that.
Yeah.
The pressure was on,
Yeah. Can you sing a bit of Where Is Love For Us Now? I just see if you...
Gotta pick a pocket or two. That's
Where Is Love.
But it was a fantastic production. And I remember I had one speaking line. Not in the warehouse, but in these are the books you ordered from the bookmaster, sir.
Okay.
And I got so nervous going on stage every night for that, not realizing that I'd end up on stage. But at that audition, it wasn't an audition as such, but there was 2 or 3 lads in the group had long hair. They were like troggy types, And a couple of, and they didn't like me because I did the end. And they thought that was a Scally magazine or, you know, short hair, neo mods and all that. And but two in the band said, oh, we, you know, we quite like his enthusiasm, you know, and his emotion and his voice. Didn't say he had a good voice. Like. But so I started rehearsing with them, and that's, we started rehearsing on a farm. And that's how we got the name.
Yeah, because they were called, I mean, I think the farm's a better name. The Excitements was the name of the band.
Shit name, yeah.
It's about, but it is. But then you could, you know, in a way, you might have got another farm. Well, the farm, so in the end, it became, when it was successful, I mean, the Beatles, I have to tell you, is one of the worst band names.
Yeah.
I know I'm in Liverpool. It's absolutely shockingly shit. That's the, it's like the B-sharps in The Simpsons. It's as bad as that. It's as bad as that. But you actually forget about the pun.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, because it's become something else. And the farm
becomes Johnny and the Moondogs, wasn't there? And the Silver Beetles, and then the Beetles with an A.
Yeah.
Which was very clever, if you think about it.
It wasn't clever. As you say, it was something that's initially amusing, gets less clever the more you hear it, which is what the B-sharps is.
But yeah, as you'd write, you don't even think about it now, don't you? No, the Rolling Stones. He's got a name like the Rolling Stones, you know.
But you're very into the legacy of yourself, but also the Beatles. You're involved in that now, and you're involved in quite a few.
Yeah, I'm involved in this thing called the Beatles Legacy Group. Yeah. You know? So I mean, it's not a job. I just do a voluntary, you know. But it's looking at, so say someone wanted the Brian Epstein statue. You know, there was a Brian Epstein committee, and they wanted the statue, and they say, let's put it down at the pier head next to the Beatles. Or we'd say, we don't think that's a good idea. It should go in Whitechapel by where NEMS was, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just advisory stuff, really.
Yeah.
So I'm not on the phone to Apple Corps. In fact, they blank everyone in Liverpool anyway, Apple Corps, you know.
But it's such, I mean, it's obviously it's such a big part of Liverpool and it's an expression of Liverpool as well, I think. I think, you know, that's why the world has taken to heart, but Liverpool's taken to heart. But obviously, it is a massive tourist thing for the city as well, the band.
It's a phenomenon, you know, it's unbelievable. There was a Beatles convention every year, and last week I went to it, you know, and everyone just comes. You got the Japanese Beatles playing, you got loads of tourists from America. They're all coming back now after COVID, like, you know. Yeah. So it is an absolute, you know, it's immense, really, you know. And I think, I was a Clash fan, so I was singing "Phony Beatlemania as bitten the dust," you know. And now I'm chair of the Legacy Group. It's a funny old world.
But that's, I mean, but music's like that. And when I think, and you know, and I was always into comedy as a kid, and then you kind of get embarrassed about the comedy you're into, or you suddenly like something else, and then you come back to it years later and you go, you know, like I think I heard you saying you listen to Genesis now and go, this is amazing, you know, whereas you would have thrown it away.
I was a Pete Gabriel fan.
Yeah.
So as soon as Pete Gabriel left Genesis, I would not listen to Genesis again. And like Pete Gabriel's proved that he's brilliant, isn't he? Yeah. And he's continued to be brilliant. But I think, it's like comedy. And in the early days, we had a band in school called Breakwind. And it wasn't the greatest name, of course, but it was me mate, really, and he was the like main figure in it. And it was just songs about teachers, taking the piss out of teachers, and no one ever listened to it because we'd rehearse on the stage, you know, in dinner time. And then one of the priests was listening, going, that's about one of the priests. And so they banned us from that.
Right. You know.
But we never actually played live, but it was just all piss takes on the teachers, basically.
Yeah.
Know? Monty Python-esque, you know, we were going through that phase of, and you look at one of my favourite bands, Half Man, Half Biscuit.
Yes.
You know. Hey. Well, I was at a wedding in Marbella last week, my wife's cousin's son, and they're all from Swindon, Irish family, but settled in Swindon. And all of a sudden, during the reception, Joy Division Oven Gloves comes on. And I'm going, is this just a mistake? Has the Spanish DJ just played this? But no, they were all into it, all these kids from Swindon. Right. So I sent Blackie, the singer, I sent him the video, and he went, oh, it's amazing that. It must be the first time it's ever been played outside the UK. So the next day, we're at like a reception, you know, post-wedding meal, and all the messages are going in the wedding book. And this lad had put two Joy Division oven gloves. So I said, I shacked him down. I said, "Oh, what is it?" And he went, "No, we're obsessed with Half Man, Half Biscuit, and that's why it was on last night."
You know? Yeah. It's terrific.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I wanted to talk to you, I have heard you talk about this, but obviously, All Together Now, which is, I think, probably my favourite pop song about the First World War armistice football match. I'm going to say that. I'm going to say it's definitely my favourite one.
What are the other ones?
What a brilliant thing to write a song about, and what a beautiful song it is. But you allowed it to be used by Everton, right?
Which was fucking hell. How many times have I been explained?
You've got to. I know this, but I'm interested in the next one.
Yeah, and we found out in 2004 when England used it for Euro 2004 that the FA were going to use it for the whole of 1996, the Euros.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have been subjected to three lines.
I know, that's what I'm saying. So it's a big mistake.
For that, but as soon as Everton used it, they scrapped the idea and asked Skinner and Badil and the Lightning Seas to do three lines. But I let them use it because I asked my dad, he's a season ticket holder and he's in his 90s and he still goes to match in his 90s. I said, what do you think? I said, I don't want them to change the lyrics. It was mainly the lyrics for me, you know, that I didn't want them to change. He said, well, if you don't let them use it, he said, you're a bit of a hypocrite, aren't you? Because it's about two enemies coming together in no man's land. He went, bastards. I've never forgiven him for them. Even when I'm at the match, derby matches, people are tapping, this is you, isn't it? You fucking let them have this, didn't you?
But it is, it's a brilliant football song. I think, I love Badil and Skinner, but Three Lions, me and Stuart Lee heard it before anyone else because we said the same management and we could hear it playing in the next room. And Stuart, who's a bit of a music snob, it has to be said, it sounds like the fucking Wombles. And he was absolutely convinced that it would die a death. So, well done to Badil and Skinner for proving him wrong. But I think, it is because it's about a football match. It's like, and it's about, I know it's about a war as well, but then it's sort of about the power of football to overcome all
it
of
It is,
those
and it's, amazing. You know, there's been some brilliant podcasts on it, by the way. You know, right. People go on to Facebook, go, never fucking happened. That never happened. And people disproving the podcast from primary evidence. You know, there's so many letters home from the German side and the British side. Yeah. That actually happened. Obviously, they weren't organised games with goalposts and lines and that. But, there were kickabouts and people fraternising and swapping. And I read the story and it became emotional reading the story. And I think Keir Hardie, the founder of the Labour Party, said he thought at the time it was the beginning of the proletarian revolution.
Right.
It never happened, of course,
I mean, it is. These little things can happen that you think of the start of something.
One of the reasons is because people were asking questions in the House of Parliament. Why is there no action on the Western Front? And it took from Christmas Day until January the 11th for the Daily Mirror to have the front cover with the soldiers on it. It took, over 2 weeks, to get... now it would have been like that,
of course,
wouldn't it? But people, Kissinger, they had to... answer questions out of Parliament why there was no activity on the Western Front, because people were refusing to fight the people, you know.
Yeah.
And then they started making up stories of atrocities and something had happened down the line, and, you know, and obviously they all started fighting again. I think court-martials were going on as well, and it never happened on the same scale as 1914. But you've got to remember 1914, it wasn't the Pals Brigades, it was like the regular army.
Yeah.
So they probably had a lot in common with the regular German army, you know?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing to pick on. You know, not many bands would think, oh, let's write a song about that, which is why it's the only one. But you know, that's... Because you were political, you know, you were very political. The rest of the band, when you started, we wanted to do love songs and you wanted to do political stuff. And obviously that stayed with you throughout your whole life.
There was a bit of that. And also when... you know, when we were doing music interviews, we were wanting to take the NME and the Melody Maker and sounds to Robert Tressel's grave, you know, the author of the Ragged Souder Plantibus, you know.
Yeah.
And they just, the journalists just wanted to talk about ecstasy. So, you know, we were in a bit of a dilemma, really, because we were trying to say, look, we're a political band as well, you know, because that was the Specials and the Clash and the Jam. But, you know, obviously hedonism was at its height and no one wanted to listen. You know?
And you had your moments of that as well, to be fair. I mean, Groovy Train is, you know, it's a political Groovy Train. But
it is, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the story.
Go on, tell me.
It was a girl from Cantle Farm where I was a youth worker, and she was into politics.
Right.
And I met her in the state in about 1990 and said, oh, you're still into all the politics? She said, Peter, get your head together, will you? I'm on the Groovy Train. And that's where they got it from.
That's good. Did you ever, how much would it cost for you to let Bisto take it and change it to we're on the Gravy Train?
Oh, I've always thought, Virgin Rail would adopt it.
I think that'd be good.
But they did on a few radio adverts, but never went for the full one, you know.
No.
But we did. We were offered a McDonald's advert for the Qatar World Cup.
Right.
We thought, we can't do it.
No.
You know, even though it was only 15 seconds or something, we just thought, we can't let them have it, you know. Well, so we still have some principles.
It's good, the money
wasn't good enough.
But that's what I like about you as well, that it is, you know, that you're principled and that's great, but there's a reality to it as well, because it's very easy to be an activist and go, oh, I'd never take the money.
Well,
but then when the money's offered to you, that's a different prospect.
There was a period in about 93... The News International got in touch.
Yeah.
And they said they wanted to use it. So our publisher rang up and said, it's a massive offer here. It's a proper, you know, lottery money, you know.
Yeah.
I said, who is it? He said, oh, it's News International. I said, yeah, but who is it? And we found out in the end it was the Sun.
Yeah.
And we said, we can't. Yeah. What? You're fucking mad. It's only a few people. And it said, no, we can't. I can't go. We can't do it. It's just impossible, you know, to do. And then a group called Hurricane Number One.
Yeah.
Have you heard of them? They'd
no.
already done the advert in black and white. It was like our original Altogether Now advert, thinking they could just buy us off, you know. But you know, we kept to our print. Bastard.
Yeah.
Why wasn't it the Daily Mirror?
I mean, but there are times when you have to say that. But there are, you know, you couldn't have done that.
No, we couldn't have done it because we already turned Piers Morgan's car over.
Yeah, tell us
around about the same time.
Tell us about that.
We were doing like a Capital Radio stock car racing show. So there was us in the middle of the field with Madness, and we were both miming to various songs and that. And we'd taken a lot of Guinness on board that day, you know. And anyway, we saw no one wanted to go in the stock cars because we were all over the limit, like. But Roy, our drummer, said, "Oh, I'll have a go." We hadn't drunk as much, and we saw him. 2 pints, maybe. But anyway, we saw Piers Morgan and a Sun car pull up. And Roy was behind him. He said, there's that bastard Piers Morgan. Because he did the Bizarre column in the Sun.
Yeah.
He was, you know, nobody really knew him then. So it was Lee from Madness. We all looked at each other and we went, charge! And so we ran over, tipped the car, and we tipped it over. And as it went over, it was upside down. And the diesel was dropping, you know, onto the floor. And Lee was going, get the fucking matches. And I'm not joking. Piers Morgan was screaming. You know, we could have done society a big favour.
You really could. You know, there's those moments you look back on. It's like going back to Finding Baby Hitler. You had...
We've got good footage of it. Carl Hunter took the footage of it. We will release it one day when we know how to. Because it's on cine camera. But anyway, the next day, Piers Morgan turned it round to my mate, the farm. Because what he'd done is, after the incident, he'd gone running up to Keith Mullen, our guitarist, put his arm round him. Now, he had the helmet on. Keith's looking at him like, that doesn't know who it is. And he gets the picture like
right.
that.
Right, yeah.
If that was the internet now, we would be fucking finished.
Yeah.
Because everyone would be saying, there's Keith with his mate Piers Morgan. He didn't even know who he was. He had the fucking helmet on.
Yeah.
And the next day, it turned it round, and we thought, he's going to go far. Right? He's a clever bastard. He totally turned it round as if we were all in on it together. And we were, you know, we were trying to do him damage.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, though, because you were, you know, you. It's interesting you went that way. And that shows what kind of a mind he has. Because, you know, some journalists might go, right, I'm going to hammer them. I'm going to find out anything I can about them. I'm going to, you know, yeah. I'm going to slate them in the press. And he twisted it. And it's much worse for you than he did it. It's clever.
We went to a smash hits party. And we wouldn't talk to the son, you see, of course. And we wouldn't talk to him even through press agents, you know what I mean? So anyway, take that at the bar. Now, take that weren't the massive phenomenon. So they were talking at the bar. Piers Morgan was there. And he saw our manager, Kevin. So we come running over and said, we just won Indie Band of the Year or something. And he said, look, I know you won't speak to me, but just fax me anything. Faxes, remember them? just fax me anything. It doesn't have to, you make it up, do anything, but I just need something, some copy. It can be a pile of shite, which obviously it was in the sun, you know.
Yeah. Not that any of you would know. Because you never read it. It actually really turned up. I'd like to know how your new lawnmowers. Going, is it all right?
The new lawnmower out. Right, it's good, but it's tough, you know.
Yeah.
You know, in a wet summer, the handheld lawnmower is a disaster.
Handheld. What made you choose the handheld lawnmower?
I just thought, you know, I don't want to get electrocuted.
Is that what it was? Do you want to cut through?
And those petrol ones look too complicated.
Yeah.
You know, so...
You know, the major, the coughing major from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire cut like three of his toes off with a strimmer. So you're in the...
And our ex-manager, Kevin, nearly killed himself with one of them strimmers, yeah.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, that's why.
So I'm just a bit wary of electrical garden instruments.
That's
you know?
Good. I'm just interested to know. There's an interview with you and John Robb. It's quite a long interview at the end of your new lawnmower arrives. It was during lockdown.
That was during lockdown. I thought, we'll keep fit as well.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, obviously everyone, you know, have different opinions on lockdown, but loads of people to me said, I quite enjoyed lockdown. The governments are sending you money. The governments are sending you money and you're going on walks to the beach, which you'd never done before, you know. But, you know, obviously it was a hard time for people with what was going on. But, you know, for me, it didn't really change that much because I'm at home all the time anyway, apart from festivals, you know.
Yeah. So are you happy with your life? Is it a nice life? Is it nice?
Yeah, well.
Is it?
I've got no complaints. And, I've tried to be honest to myself and do it, you know. But, you know, obviously you think maybe we should have had a business plan for the end. Because everyone's always talking about it. In fact, in 2011... it came out as the 20 copies, and James Brown from Loaded fame, he released it, you know, and he put a bit of money behind it and that. And it came out and it did very well. In fact, Waterstones in Liverpool was the only Waterstones in the country where Jamie Oliver's Christmas cookbook wasn't number one.
Right.
It was the end.
Yeah, but it's amazing to have like one phenomena like that, and it doesn't, you know, and that it's, I mean, for me, I love those, the things that are cult hits, the things that are, you know, really important to a specific group of people and another group of people. You know, you say that, you went around the country and said the end to most people, most people aren't going to know what it is, but the people who know it still love it. And it's not quite the same with the farm because the farm was bigger than that. But
well, I think from what I can gather, a lot of people said it inspired them to write.
Yes.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's brilliant, isn't it, to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and when we went on, we used to go on tour with Ted Chippington.
Yes.
You know, and we loved Ted Chippington. We absolutely loved him.
Yes.
And he was an end reader, I think, you know. Right. And there was also this apocryphal story about Viz saying to us, how do you sell 5,000 copies a week, you know? And I asked Phil Jones, the editor, says, is that true, that story a few years ago? He goes, no, I made it up.
But you know,
going around telling everyone that for years.
That's very interesting you bring up those. I mean, Ted Chippington was like, but both, before we met each other, both me and Stu had the Ted Chippington records and really got into them. And actually, Stu's stand up. He acknowledges that I owes a massive favour, you know, to Ted Chippington. But it did remind me of Viz, and Viz obviously is the outwardly comedy version of that. But that was that tiny. It was the 1970s, 1980s. Someone could come up with an idea like that could then become nationwide. And Viz is so influential in comedy. I think I have all the things really. It doesn't really get the credit it deserves, but it's so influential throughout comedy. So I'm sure that's also true of
absolute genius, wasn't it? But a lot of our cartoons in the end were very funny as well, done by a like called John Potter, and they were absolutely brilliant. And it was like, it'd be like pictures from Yeats's Wine Lodge and that, people, under the tables and diving through the air. And it was like exaggerations, of course, but, comedy comes from exaggeration, doesn't
it?
It
does. And there was just something about, there was just something about that time. And maybe it felt like when podcasts started, it was a bit like, I thought this could be a sort of punky, it was punky and people just making stuff themselves in their house. And then it's quickly turned into something just horrifying.
Well, everyone's got a podcast now.
Now it's all very well produced. Not this one. We stayed relatively punky, but the really early ones were people just having a go and being as offensive as they wanted and trying out crazy ideas, which still does happen. It's mainly me doing them, but there are.
Do you listen to Top Flight Time Machine?
No, I like that one.
I mean, it's great when you walk in the dog or whatever and listen to it, and it's fantastic stuff,
So it's great, and I think that's what I really admire about the end and the farm is that it's this self-created thing that shouldn't really, that no one would have said, oh, let's make that, no, let's have that, that you, the only the people involved in it said, let's do it.
Yeah.
Well, and you're in charge of it, and it's your thing until
it's just,
Tony
it was involved. Purely chance, it's purely chance, really. I think music and football, I was going to lots of concerts, but I was also going to lots of football matches, and I thought, there's no fanzine that represents that. You buy student rag mags off the street, and you'd look at it and you go, that's shit.
Yeah, they were.
That's absolute. But, so then I saw an anarchist magazine in Probe Records.
Right.
And Annie, who used to run Probe with Jeff Davis, who sadly just passed away. But I saw this anarchist magazine. It was about the royal wedding. So that time date, 81, was it?
Yeah,
81. 81. And I saw this anarchist magazine. I thought, and it was so cruel, the humour. I thought, this is absolutely brilliant, but no one's going to read it because it's an anarchist magazine.
Right.
So I always remember John Lennon saying, Liverpool humour is cruel. It really is cruel, but, it can be very funny as well. And it's how you stand up to it and how you react to that cruelty, So I thought, well, let's get a magazine which just takes the piss out of everything, every sacred cow in the city. And it worked, some people got upset by it. There was a local DJ, and he's a great friend of ours now, Billy Butler. Okay. And he was in the ins column and the outs column at the same time, just to confuse everyone, And, some people got upset by it. We put them in the out column and they'd go, why am I in the out column? It's a fucking joke. Don't worry about it. But that became a phenomenon, really. And I think by doing that, people were saying, who are these guys? Who are these guys? And John Peel championed it, by the way.
Yeah.
Because we sent him a letter saying, look, John, you might think, Georgian folk music is big, but it's not on the council estates of Liverpool. And he said he read the letter and thought, cheeky bastards. But then he thought, oh, I'd like to meet them. Yeah.
It's the Liverpool, is exactly what you say, is that Liverpool humour of being cheeky and being rude and having to cope with it.
Some people could cope with it, like Pete Burns was the past master at it. He used to have a load of scallies walking down Church Street behind him, giving him stick, and he'd turn around and give them funnier stick to them. And Tony Wilson used to have it all the time, because what's written out of the Tony Wilson books and history is that he spent a lot of his time from 76 to 1980 in Liverpool.
Right.
Going to Eric's, and he was known as the twat in the suit, in the white suit. But he used to go to Eric's a lot, and he wanted something similar in, and that was became Factory.
Right.
Because he worked with Roger Eagle quite a lot.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, it's mainly that narrative is written out of all the Manchester books, you know. But Tony was, you know, he was a brilliant character. We loved him. And when he passed away, we sent a floral tribute from all Liverpool bands, from Liverpool with love. Because
right.
we remember in the 1980s, he organised a concert round the corner at the Royal Court from Manchester with love to a benefit for the Searchard City Councillors.
Right.
So New Order were on it, the Smiths were on it, the Four were on it, John Cooper Clarke. So we remembered that. And we sent this, and this floral tribute, because it was all groups got together, it was fucking massive. And it ended up in the hearse from Liverpool with love. And they were going around Manchester. Tony Wilson was going around Manchester. Past the Hacienda, we're from Liverpool with love. And even his son said at the graveyard, he went, he'd see the funny side of that.
He really would. Oh, man, I mean, there's so many stories you could tell us, and it's really fascinating to hear all this stuff. I hope you've written it all down and put it some. Have you got an autobiography?
No,
could do an autobiography.
I thought about doing a book, but I did the Boot Room book. I've done a couple of Liverpool books, you know, but I haven't really. But I could get the anecdotes down. But maybe I'd get someone else to write it. John Robb,
he'll do it for you.
He's enthusiastic.
Well, look, it's an amazing story, and it's such a pleasure and honour to meet you, ladies and gentlemen. Please get up, the amazing Pete Doudna.
Thank you.
Come back next week. Go and have a break, and come back next week, and we'll have more for you. Thank you very much. You have been listening to Rahulastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Peter Hooton. Thank you to Scant Regard for this lovely music. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, or that one, for all of his work. And Ben Evans, why not? Let's thank him too, not that one either. Thank you also to George Lingford, the incompetent soundman, and Bexcliff, who've been coming with me on the road. It's been very exciting. And thank you to everyone at the Playhouse in Liverpool. They've been lovely. Thank you for having us. This is Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. RichardHerring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who's said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.